Matters with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 24th episode of Robots, where we'll be speaking about art, engineering, and freedom with two robot artists building gigantic robots. We first speak with Theo Jansen, a physics major turned artist out of the Netherlands, about his walking beach creatures and how he perceives robotics and builds sculptures that can walk and sense their environments in a very different way than the robots we are used to.
We then speak to Jamie Mansell, who was an inventor in Vermont. Throughout his life, he's been literally building his dreams with his own two hands, be it a home in the mountains or a giant six-legged robot he plans to use to take him around. But first, as always, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Robot toymaker Ugobi, inventor of the amazing Pleo dinosaur robot, has filed for bankruptcy. The company's being liquidated, all employees have already been let go. In spite of 100,000 Pleos sold, the company has failed to raise additional funding. This is truly sad news for all robot fans, and let's hope Caleb Chung, creator of Pleo and the highly successful Furby, will give consumer robotics another shot. We promise we'll buy. Carnegie Mellon University has announced this year's inductees into the Robot Hall of Fame. The new members are NASA's Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity, the iRobot Roomba, the Da Vinci Medical Robot System, Huey, Dewey and Louie from the 1971 film Silent Running, and the T-800 Terminator from the 1984 film The Terminator. For the second time in a row, real robots outnumber fictional ones in what Matt Mason, director of Carnegie Mellon's Robotic Institute, calls the beginning of a trend, because robots are increasingly approaching or even exceeding performance levels that once were only imagined. The U.S. Army, in cooperation with Utah State University, has developed an autonomous rotorcraft sniper system. It consists of an unmanned helicopter and a remotely operated sniper rifle, which can fire one sniper shot every 6 seconds. The project's heads say the airborne robo-sniper idea was put forward 5 years ago, but only became practical when Utah State University's Space Dynamics Laboratory designed a lightweight, stabilized turret. According to the laboratory's website, a key element of the program is the use of commercial off-the-shelf components to reduce cost and the time needed for development. The operator's station is similar to a video game. A modified Xbox 360 gaming controller is used for aiming, arming, and firing. For more information and discussion on this week's news, including Ugobi's demise, the new inductees to CMU's Robot Hall of Fame and the autonomous sniper helicopter, visit the Robots Forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Theo Jansen is an artist best known for his strand beast, or beach animals, a new form of life that he is creating out of plastic yellow tubes. Jansen's ultimate goal is to release his creations into the wild to have them roam the beaches of his native Netherlands in herds and lead their own type of mechanical lives. Let's hear what he has to say.
Hi, Theo. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Thank you.
As opposed to many of our roboticist guests, you consider yourself more of an artist, I guess, than a roboticist. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Well, I don't know what I am, or a scientist, or an artist, or a robotist. It's just an inner feeling, and I think the institutes put the names on it. Like universities, they call you scientist, and the museums call me an artist. I don't think it really matters. It's just the inner drive to explore things. Like everybody has that basically in their mind, I guess. But I feel like an Eskimo. I mean, Eskimos, they make nice sculptures, maybe for religious reasons, and they also do inventions on the kayak, but they have no idea what robotism is or robotics is, and they don't know what art is, and just they do it. And I think I want to go back to that feeling of that there are no institutes and you just want to work on your inner motivation. And well, I started this about this beach animals about 19 years ago by writing, because I write a column for a newspaper here in Holland, and this was a column in the paper. So after some time, I got the idea I could realize this column by using this electricity conduits, which are used in Holland for electricity cables in houses to put in. And so I started building small skeletons. And while doing that, I get more and more ideas. And so I promised myself to spend 1 year on the animals then. And that 1 year is still going on. It's about 19 years ago. And that still keeps me awake at night. It really has taken me like a virus, you could say. Mm-hmm. But I feel very happy with it.
So speaking of these beach animals or strand beasts, I guess, is that how you say it in Dutch? Strand beast?
Yes, strand beast.
This is what you're best known for. Can you explain a bit what exactly is a strand beast, and maybe visually, so that people listening can get a bit of an idea of what it is?
Well, it are skeletons of yellowish tube. I would say the color is like cheese, and they can become very quite high, and they walk on the wind on the beaches. And the idea is that they can walk there without me, so independently. And in the years, there was a sort of evolution, and so they developed to survive the storms and the wind silences, and also the waves of the sea and the tides. And at the end of my life, I have to be that far that they can do without me, so that I could quietly die and the animals just live forever. And the idea is that I restrict myself very much in my materials. So I use only these kind of conduits, and there's a sort of parallel to the existing nature, because the existing forms of life are made just of protein. So you could say that the creator restricted himself in the choice of his materials as well. So I want to do the same thing, and I just want to make this animals using this PVC conduits.
Okay, you're often talking about them as if they're not one of your creations. They're actually there and they're alive. They're animals. They have their own thoughts and such. Can you maybe expand on that a little bit? What's your philosophical maybe outlook on these creations?
Yes, for me that's a myth as well. But usually I work on the animals to function, like they must walk all right, and they must be strong enough to survive the storms. But usually at the end, I didn't succeed that much in making them functional, but when I look at it, I'm struck by the beauty of it, as if I didn't make it myself. And it seems like the tubes, they direct me in a certain way that they become beautiful. So I didn't really make these animals. It's just the tubes which told me what to do, you could say, because the restrictions of the material they block my way and they send me another way, and this is the way we are created. And so I think in real in the existing evolution, the same thing happened because of the restriction of protein, and because protein is not a very, you wouldn't say that protein is a very good construction material, but it is used. And also the path was very curly and capricious, and so it was just steered by the protein. So we are not made by anybody, but we are made by the protein, by the circumstances the protein survived. And that's also, I think, that's the reason why it's hard to mention an animal, a species, which is not fascinating to look at. I mean, even a spider or a pig, they're all fascinating to see. And I think it's not because because it's not made by man, but it's made by reality. And that's also what happens, I hope to happen, with my creatures. So they have a certain identity of an entity, or I don't know what it is. It's something which I don't understand.
Speaking of the materials, then, how did you choose these yellow tubes? Or, I mean, is it only yellow tubes you use, or connecting parts? Where do the materials come from, and why these materials?
Well, in the beginning, it's because it was cheap, because it's only 10 cents a meter. And so being poor was my first reason to use these kind of tubes. But while using it, it turns out to be a very flexible and cooperating material. And apart from that, it becomes also beautiful just because of the shine. I don't know what it is. Of course, you need connection material. So in the beginning, I used sellotape to connect the tubes, and also zip ties, cable ties, and also bamboo sticks or chopsticks. But I try to find ways now to make it more pure. So last month, I'm working on tubes which, that the whole thing is pure PVC tube. Mm-hmm. And I succeed in that. So you can make springs of it, and also attaching parts. So you don't need the zip ties anymore, and not anymore the bamboo sticks to connect the tubes. Okay. It becomes more pure PVC, more yellow.
More yellow, more like cheese.
Yes, that's right.
So tell us maybe a bit more some of the subsystems of these beasts so we can imagine them in our heads more. For example, the legs. It's one of, I guess, the big features of these skeletons is the way they walk. How does it work?
I think the way they walk is, in fact, the reason why everybody seems to be interested, because it turns out to be that move that it's appeals to the feeling of animals. And the reason is, I think, because I developed it writing a genetic algorithm in a computer, in an Atari computer, 18 years ago. Hmm. And because of finding out the length of the tubes to... let me explain first. In the middle of each animal, there's a sort of backbone which makes a circular movement. And this circular movement is transformed by 12 tubes into a complex movement of the foot. And the complex movement is very simple, in fact, because it is a sort of ellipse, mm-hmm. and has a flat bottom. And so it moves horizontally, just like when the foot is on the ground, it moves horizontal, just like the axis of a wheel in a straight line. And that means the animal doesn't lose any energy tossing up and down. It stays on the same level and the feet walk under it. And finding out the length of the tubes needed for that motion, I wrote this genetic algorithm, which took months, day and night, to find out which length of tubes are needed to make these feet. So they came to 12 numbers, 12 lengths of tubes, and that's what I call the 12 holy numbers, because they walk already 18 years on this combination of numbers.
So you always use the same length of tube, just scaled up or down for your robots?
That's right. The proportion is all the same. The size may be different, but the scale may be different, but the proportion of the length of tubes is always the same.
What about the number of legs? I've seen some with quite a few legs. Is there a maximum that you've done? Is there a minimum that you need to walk?
Yeah, there's a minimum of 11 legs to keep the balance. So they need at least 11 legs, but usually the strength beast has a lot more legs. So I'm working now on an animal which has, let me see, 36 legs.
Wow.
And because there are so many legs, don't have to be very strong to lift the weight of the. So you can put quite some weight on it and build high constructions on it because you have a lot of legs.
Let's maybe speak about some of the other subsystems, because you've come up with some really interesting mechanical paradigms to other things that are used in other robots, such as sensors or energy storage or energy creation. Let's talk about how do you power these robots? Or should I call them robots, actually, or would you call them just strand beasts?
Well, I call them strand beasts.
Okay.
Because a robot, you usually think of something like a man, an artificial man, and it's not an artificial man, it's just a new kind of creature. So, but they use the wind for their energy. So that has a big advantage, that they don't have to eat comparing with the other animals. And on top, there's usually a wing which moves in a sort of wave motion. So their head is always in the wind. And this wave motion is transformed to motion of feet. So they walk sideways on the wind, just like a crab.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays they are able to store the wind. So while moving the wind, they have pumps connected with them. So they pump up air in soda bottles, which are on the back. And these soda bottles I call the wind stomach,
mm-hmm.
because it's stored energy. And they can use this energy in case that the wind falls away on the beach and the tide would come up. They still have a small amount of energy to reach the dunes and save their lives. So they are armed against wind silences, you could say.
That's really impressive. And how do they know that the tide is coming up?
Well, they have sensors as well. So they use also pumps so that they have a water feeler, which is nothing but a tube going over the ground about 2 inches, and it's sucking air in all the time. And as soon as it comes into the sea, it swallows the water, and it feels the resistance of the water, and then it's felt by the air, and then it's out of the sea again as a reaction.
Okay. What was one of the biggest challenges for you, the hardest piece to design?
To survive the storms is quite hard to do, because they don't like side winds too much. And I really look forward that they can survive in the winter here on the beaches as well, because usually I go to the beach every year in the spring. But they are not able to survive the winters yet, because they break every time. And so hopefully in a few years they will be strong enough to survive the winter as well. And I'm 61 now, so hopefully I have still about 20 years to go. Mm-hmm. And I'm really working very hard on it.
One of the things I saw was a hammer device that one of your beach animals could hammer into the ground, into the sand, to not be blown away by the wind. Can you tell us about that a bit?
Well, that's working quite well these days, because using the pneumatics of the air, you can make all kind of things to be armed against the storm. So when the storm is very strong, they need to hammer a pin in the ground near the nose. And when the nose is fixed, the whole animal is fixed, because it's always turning its nose into the wind then. Mm-hmm. Just like a sail ship, which has anchored. So it can anchor itself for real storms. And, well, that's working quite well. The only thing is they have to still need to count their steps to know where they are on the beach and that kind of things. So that's all coming in the coming years, I guess. And so I'm working very hard on that.
So is this part of the brain that you're trying to design? Because I guess we have all the mechanical components and the sensors, but is there any computation on board?
Yeah, well, using pneumatics, you can also build a sort of bit, just like in a computer, saying, yes, there is air, and no, there's no air, so zeros and ones. And you can make binary counters with that, and also time mechanisms which run parallel to the tides, so they know in advance when the water will come up, so they can anticipate on that situation. So that's all coming.
Okay.
I have to work hard, I guess.
like with everything, I guess. You're solving, using your beach animals, you're solving a lot of problems that a lot of traditional roboticists are also trying to solve. Have you ever been tempted to maybe throw some electronics in there, throw a little microcontroller or a little electronic sensor?
Well, I've been seduced many times because it, of course, electronics is a good way to solve problems. But until now, I could resist the seduction quite well.
Okay. What about a practical application? Have you looked at all in creating a transport vehicle, for example, or something that could then be used maybe, I don't know, on the moon or in space? Or are you really just focusing on making these beach animals alive, just for the sake of being alive?
Well, I think they could be used for not for the moon, not for rocky or uneven surfaces, but they could walk in the swamps quite well, and I think they could be used in aquaculture, or like in rice fields or something. They could use it to instead of tractors, you could use this kind of leg system to walk in soft grounds, and because they're better in soft ground than wheels. And so that might be an application, but I'm not working on it myself. If people want to use it for that thing, I will be welcome. I will give them the 20 of the 12 holy numbers with pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Have you been approached by anybody yet? Any companies or universities that were interested in building a maybe more electronic version?
Yeah, well, I've been invited many times for lectures to universities and of robotics as well to tell them about my work, but they're not using. Well, there's a group of students in the United States, and they built a Segway with my leg system, which was nice.
Mm-hmm. That's impressive.
You know, Segway, the way of transportation. You're standing straight up, and then two wheels are moving, and instead of the two wheels, they have this leg system.
Mm-hmm. And does it work?
It works, yeah, very well. It's also on YouTube somewhere.
One really impressive creation of yours that I saw was the Adamaris rhinoceros transport. It's this, I guess, 2-ton big walker that can be pulled by a single person. How would you do that?
In fact, it's a reinvention of the wheel, like I said, and that has the same qualities as a wheel. So it goes very light, even if the weight is very strong, very high, very heavy. So the weight was 3.2 tons, and still it could move. Just you can move a car, mm-hmm. and this was more than a car. But the beginning is quite hard, and the wind can move it as well. So it worked quite well on the wind as well.
Okay. As a last question, what is the goal of your project? What do you see in the future? So in 20 years' time, what's your big vision for your beach animals?
Well, I think it can be said in one word, surviving. Surviving, letting them survive. And that's my real aim, that they survive on their own. And I don't have to take care of them anymore. Just like children, you just kick them out of the door. And just say, well, do it yourself. This is a way to make mental children. So they're children of my mind. And they are not only on the beach they're living, but they're living very much in the internet as well, which is very nice to see, of course.
Great. Theo, thank you very much for being on the Robots Podcast.
Okay, Adam. And we lots of success with your work.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Jamie Mansell's adventures have been followed by the thousands on YouTube as he strives to build a gigantic spider-like robot to carry him around. But the giant robot project is not his first, since he has years of experience building anything to everything, including the 4-story Jamie Dome where he lives in a corner of the mountains in Vermont. Besides talking about robots, we'll be looking at a more general philosophy of life and art.
Hi, Jamie. Welcome to Robots.
Oh, thank you very much.
Maybe start by telling us a bit about yourself.
Well, I'm Canadian. I grew up in the suburbs, and I didn't particularly like the suburbs, which is why I moved out to the woods. And I've always been into inventing things that I've never seen before.
Inventing things, what type of things have you invented so far?
I've invented a lot of different things, but one thing that I always come back to is robots, usually walking ones. I've been doing that since I was a little kid, and I'll go and invent other things, but I'll always come back to some kind of walking robot, it seems.
So, walking robots, I know you built a small walking robot, which you're using as a model for a bigger one. So first, maybe describe this small spider-like robot you've created.
Well, it has a centerpiece, and then there's these 6 legs coming out from the middle, and it doesn't really have a front or a back. The 6 legs just come straight out with no indication of which direction they'll go. And the head, which is the middle part, rotates, and whichever direction it's facing, all the legs will start walking. So the whole thing doesn't have to turn around for it to steer. It just walks in whichever direction the head is facing.
What is the reason for you wanting to scale up?
Because ever since I started building these walking robots when I was a little kid, people always said, wow, that would be so cool if it was huge, and I totally agree with them. And one of the first inspirations I had was watching Robotech, and I always thought it was really cool when they had those giant robots. And that's kind of how I started thinking about building robots of my own. They just started as small models, usually like 12 inches, maybe 1.5 feet tall, out of popsicle sticks and coat hangers a lot of the time, and then I worked my way up. And I kind of got to the point where I'm like, okay, I need to make a big one. So that's what I'm doing now.
So what do you mean by big?
Well, this one's going to be about 12 feet tall and maybe 15 or 18 feet wide. I'm not sure the exact dimensions. But it's not really as big as I ultimately want to build one, but it's about 15 times bigger than any other ones I've built, and it'll be big enough to get in and drive it around like a vehicle.
So is that how you plan to control it, basically sitting on top of it?
Yeah. I'm going to have two seats, and there will be a driver's seat and a passenger seat. And I think at first the passenger seat is going to have a generator in it because batteries are really expensive, so I'm just going to put a generator in the passenger seat to power the electric motor.
I really like your website at jamius.com, and it's really fascinating to see everything you have to build to finally get to your huge robot. Basically, you have to, before you build this robot, you have to build a workshop, etc. So maybe you can walk us through the steps that you've been having to go through to build this huge robot.
Okay, when I started to build the giant robot, I actually originally applied for a few grants, hoping to be able to build it at some workshop somewhere that's sponsored for artists. And there are a bunch, but I didn't really get any responses. I'm not sure if people didn't take me seriously or they just thought it was a stupid idea or what. But I decided I was going to build it anyway. So I started building a workshop on the mountain. And to do that, I built a lumber mill so that I could turn trees into lumber so I didn't have to buy it and drag it all the way up the mountain because there's no road to my place. It keeps getting more and more complicated the further I go in. But but then I kind of put the workshop on hold while I went on a trip to visit my father in Florida and started working on the robot in his garage there and got to the point where it's about 80% finished. But the next pieces were the leg pieces, which are enormous, and I didn't want to fill up his whole garage with all these giant robot pieces. So I came back up to Vermont, and in the process, I met this guy who was getting rid of this old airplane hangar, and I thought, wow, that would be an amazing workshop, and I can put that together probably faster than I could finish the one I've been working on. Plus, I've always kind of wanted one of these airplane hangars, and it's pretty big. It's like big enough to play basketball in. So I got that, and I had to get it up the mountain, so I dug a road for a mile and a half through the mountain in Vermont, and a lot of it was along a 45-degree slope, so there was a lot of digging. Some days I only made it about 10 feet, but that took about a month and a half. But finally I got a road up to my place and drove all the building pieces up there and put it all together over the winter, and now it's basically finished. I just have to dig out the floor a little bit, which froze before I got to finish digging it out. But now I think I'm ready to finish the giant robot in that big airplane hangar building.
So you said you live in the woods. So maybe you can tell us a bit more about that.
Oh, okay, yeah. 6 years ago, I bought a mountain in Vermont. Well, it's not specifically a mountain. It's 20-something acres, but basically it's a mountain. And the land was really cheap because there's no road to this property, which I think is totally cool because I like to exercise a lot, and this gives me an excuse to walk up and down a mountain every day. It does get a little difficult when I'm dragging materials up there. So when I first built the dome I live in, it's this big four-story dome thing. It was kind of a lot of work to drag all the pipes and the concrete up there. But a year and a half ago, I dug a road. Actually, no, it was just last summer. I dug a road to my place, so now I can actually drive in as long as the ground is dry, but only in my four-wheel drive truck.
I'm trying to figure out if this is fun or not.
Oh, yes, it's very fun. It's also very difficult. But it's a really fun adventure. And all these things, they're really hard work, but I get to see all this progress and all these cool things happening. Like now I have this big building that I can do anything I want in. And I guess I could have worked at a boring job and made lots of money and bought my own workshop. But this way is way more fun. And I really feel like it's mine because I dragged all the pieces up there. I dug out the foundation by hand. I put the bricks in, put it all together. And I think I'm actually going to bury it. So it's like kind of like a secret hideout. And while I've been doing this, one of the things I think about is, like, you know how there's always evil mad scientists in cartoons and video games, and they're always old? Well, I figured out why they're old. It's because it takes their entire life to build their secret mountain hideout where they can make their giant robots and take over the world. Not that I'm interested in taking over the world or anything.
I guess that makes sense. Can you give us more detail on the technical aspects of your robot? So what kind of materials are you using for these huge legs? What type of actuators and the energy? You said it would be a generator, basically.
Sure. For the small robot, I used plastic and molded plastic parts. And I made positive pieces out of clay or whatever I could find to make the right shape, and then made a rubber mold of that, and then made plastic pieces from the rubber molds. And that went really well, but I didn't think I could make the huge one out of plastic that way, because one, it wouldn't be strong enough, and two, it would be really, really expensive. So I started building it with aluminum, and I wasn't sure where I was going to find all this aluminum, but I've been pretty lucky at the scrapyard and with a couple people finding out about the robot and giving me some aluminum pipes and stuff like that. So it's about 90% aluminum and a little bit of steel. And I'm not entirely sure if the aluminum is going to be strong enough, so I'm not going to actually get in it on the first test drive, just in case something falls apart and I might die horribly. And everything in it is mechanical, except for just, you know, there's an electric motor. There's two electric motors, actually, in the small one. In the big one, I think I'm only going to use one electric motor and have the steering manual, kind of like a big bus steering wheel. And you just turn it, and you can rotate where you sit, like the cockpit, all the way around 360 degrees. And then whichever direction you're facing, you hit a switch, and then the electric motor will start, and you'll start walking in that direction. But there's everything after the electric motor is mechanical. It's all gears and levers, and that's, yeah, basically it, gears and levers. Lots of joints.
So I know you started Brown University as an engineer and then went to art. Do you consider your project, the giant robot project, as engineering or art, or both?
Yeah, I don't really separate the two, engineering art. I guess I kind of think of it as more of the Leonardo da Vinci times, where art and engineering went together. They weren't separate now, like they are now. Now art is mostly considered aesthetic things, but historically, it wasn't like that.
When did you start building the robot, and when do you think you'll finish?
Well, I started it a year and a half ago, I think. Yeah, about a year and a half ago. But I plan to finish it this spring or summer. I have about a month of work left on it, so it shouldn't be a problem as long as I can push the rest of my life aside to make time for it, which I totally plan to do.
And what do you think you'll do after?
Oh, after that. Well, I have a whole bunch of other inventions in mind. One is that I want to build a really, really big robot. Like, this one's about 15 times bigger than anything I've built before, and I'd really like to build one that's, like, 15 times bigger than that, like maybe 150 feet tall. Now, that would be a very big undertaking, and I would definitely need a lot of help with that. But through my website and my YouTube videos and things like that, I've been meeting people who are kind of into building things like this and might be able to help with a really large-scale project. But some of the shorter-term things I want to build are an amphibious solar-powered RV so I could drive around the country, and then whenever I run out of electricity, I can just hang out in the RV until the sun comes out and charges it up again. And then I can drive around again. And then whenever I hit water, I could just drive right under the water and keep going, which I think would be great.
Yeah, definitely. I wish you the best of luck, Jamie, and thanks a lot for being here with us on Robots.
Well, thank you very much.
That's it for this episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. And of course, don't forget to stop by the forum for discussion on today's show and other hot topics in robotics. And thanks to everyone that voted in last week's poll on whether a private company could manage to land a robot on the moon by 2014 and win the Google X Prize. Looks like 61% of the people are optimistic, so let's hope it happens.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Roam the outdoors with robots. the podcast for news and views on robotics.